Chapter 13, Melody Ranch. Van Beek's gunboat was waiting off Mud Island as they slipped through the shallows at half steam, their paddles thumping the water like a whitey woman's washing with slow, laborious thuds. Pale light touched the city's tallest shards and revealed the gunboat, manned by gaudy ruffians, huge men armed with a tinker's wagon of weaponry, most of which looked spent. But they had a charge in the monstrous Cassion, which bounced a ball of unhealthy energy off the paddle wheeler's boiler deck and left two children coughing themselves to death as their parents watched helplessly from where they lay wounded under the forward awning, their skin shredding from their flesh and that flesh putrefying and turning to liquid which lay unabsorbed on the planks. The Rose was furious. The Texas foredeck bell was clanging. Waiting steam was belching into the safeties. The Rose climbed up to the wheelhouse and took over from a grim Jack Caraquasian. Without hesitation, she put the paddles into reverse, bracing herself as the boat gave a ponderous roll. Already the remains of the filthy Memphis waterfront lay behind them. Deliberately, she veered the big boat toward the channel edge where the current was less strong against them, watching as the gunboat came alongside their drifting bulk. She seemed relaxed, but Jack Caraquasian noted the tightness of her grip on the wheel's kingspoke. Beneath them, the Pearl shuddered with the violence of her pent-up pressure. She had been ready to fly as soon as she had cleared Memphis. Now it felt as if she must burst apart. Jack Caraquasian turned a thoughtful eye to the stack safeties, where bright lemon foam boiled down the dull enamel and the stacks beat like organ pipes. Then his attention was drawn to the wheelhouse of the gunboat, where a big whitey held the wheel steady. He was one of those whiteys who tried to pass for Indian by staining their skin with walnut and greasing their hair with black tallow to make them look like Plains Blackfoot. This freshly healing scar across his naked, darkened chest betrayed his blood. It's Van Beek's big Blanco pilot, and there's the Governor General himself paying us a courtesy visit. George Von Beek was easily recognised, his tiny bushman's features puffy with Cargon implants, and his right arm busy with a score of blinking Bailey monitors, their lights reflected in his mild blue eyes. Teeth flashed violet as he grimaced, swinging down the starboard ladder which his men held steady for him. He dropped onto their main deck like an elderly cat. He wore a grey and red uniform and was still used to authority. Without preamble, he made his way up to the Texas and told them he was their passenger. His own boat would follow behind to ensure his safety. He wanted the best suite they had in full service. He would disembark at St. Louis. Clearly Von Beek had no idea who they were or where the boat was going. He recognised none of them. Only Sam Okenhurst had ever worked for Boss Van Beek, and Jack Caraquasian had never known him well. After a silent discussion, they decided to let Van Beek believe he controlled them. They addressed the boss with purring politeness in the archaic manner of the old gambling clans. They called him My Handsome and Varadi Sapisti, and Boss Van Beek became almost agreeable under their clever attention. He intended to recruit whites above St. Louis and bring them back down to retake all his lost territory. There were enough weapons aboard his gunboat to arm a formidable force, and once the Blancos had served their turn, they would make useful workers in the rebuilding. As he urged the trio to join him in his great dream, it became clear that even in Memphis he had ceased to be a power, and was now just another small-time warlord trying to carve out a few miles of territory to call his own. The Rose was glad to let the paddles race and the steam take hold. Already the Pearl was settling to a sustained, purring rhythm, gathering speed as the whitey stoked Goldenwood, whose smoke was an oily, yellowish vomit. The two men spoke of getting rid of Van Beek, but the Rose no longer seemed involved. She had a Z-band play that night and treated the boss as if he were a king. They followed her example, and not once did Boss Van Beek question them or do any more than assume that the trio were ordinary boat's officers on a regular scheduled run. The Rose said Van Beek was still dangerous while that Cassillon was charged. It would cost them nothing to let him relax and think he was going to St. Louis. So they danced in the light of the mosquito lamps to the fiddle and the accordion, the guitar and the bass. Pauvre Piero, moi pirogue vous roulez. In his place of honour, his tiny feet not touching the deck, Boss Van Beek clapped his hands together, for all the world like a schoolboy at a pantomime. Bravo, belle damare. I've never seen better dancing. You will all be welcome in Memphis at the Governor-General's mansion. We'll have some celebrating to do. We'll have some lively times. Lively times ahead, boss. The Rose was a commedia coquette, openly displaying her ironic contempt for him before his brutal, unobservant eye. But he was used to fawning courtiers and had no time for flattering women, he said. He was not listening to her as he cast his thoughtful gaze back over the grumbling waters, alert for his gunboat's steady growl. Bad news, Volavade, Jack Caraquasian pretended subservient intimacy. How long before we get to St. Louis? Demanded Van Beek, refusing further questions. A 2 or 3 moons, says the Rose. No more, Surrey. And it's a clear run, right? All the way up, nobody in the way? They saw nothing wrong with offering him his required assurances. Van Beek began rapidly clapping his hands, ordering the band to start up once more and the dancers to continue. They were less wholehearted now. Van Beek was disappointed, but scarcely puzzled anymore, he confided, by the way some folks behaved. He invited Jack Caraquasian and Sam Oakenhurst to take a drink with him in the saloon. He said they had the look of gambling men. He himself enjoyed a game from time to time. He liked the real thing. They would have believed the power he'd tapped into. The games had been hard, but few had beaten him. Even the keenest jugadors. He wouldn't play these ersatz pseudo-flats. They told the boss they had 2 brackets aboard. Was he familiar with those? He became interested in a lordly way. They coaxed him down into the cabin. He played badly. They let him win and kept winning, wondering when he would realize what they were doing. He never realized. He fully believes he's lucky by divine right, Sam Oakenhurst exclaimed when Van Beek had finally tired of playing and returned to his own cabin. Thanks to our efforts, Jack, things are coming out just as they should for Boss Van Beek. At Cahan, the Rose went ashore to buy a few provisions while the boat was wooding up. The place was almost deserted, and she was glad to find one small Chandler's still operating down near the old jetties. The Chandler was glad to see her and was generous with his measures, warning her that just below St. Louis the river turned around and began flowing north, becoming rapids and then huge falls, where Missouri used to be. All the border states were one vast abyss of diseased and glistening rock, he said, which had parted like a rotten seam one afternoon. And pouring upwards from those immeasurable depths rose a kind of bloody vapour, as if the last remains of the dead were striving for the upper air. She remarked that he was of a poetic disposition, and he told her he was once a singer. I know who you are, he said. Captain Von Beck. I've been in your company once or twice. I performed at the Kettle Kettle in St. Joe, and he lifted his head to remind her of his song. When your long, long journey's over, through the mountains and the snows, it's the seed you plant in winter that in spring becomes a rose. When she returned to the boat, the Rose mentioned nothing of her news to Boss Van Beek. Later, Van Beek locked himself in a conference with a lieutenant from the gunboat. He had been abstracted, as if he had heard uncertain news. The Rose spoke of this to Sam Okenhurst and Jack Karakwazian. They agreed that Von Beek's men might have picked up rumours, but were probably discounting them. Such apocalyptic stuff was widespread these days. They get it from those magazines you read, Sam. Half-serious, Jack Karakwazian teased his friend. It's spreading into the real world. People will believe anything. Are you angry, Jack? What is it, some disappointment? If you like, Sam. Jack Karakwazian began to cough softly and, excusing himself, returned to his regular suite, which now adjoined Van Beek's. His disease had been in remission for some time, but had returned last night. He was careful with his measure of Aykroyds. He hung up his silk jacket and brocaded vest, slipped off his bright black boots, loosened his belt and his collar, and lay back in his best easy chair, on the arm of which lay a recent copy of Captain Billy Bob's Monthly, relating the latest tales of the Chaos Captains and unstable power dyes which threatened to burn off the plastic and blind the viewer. The Monthly's main story involved the search for a lost universe with an unlikely name. There was a further episode in the ongoing Quest for the Fishlings, and a number of other stories involving minor characters from one series in major roles. Professor Pop and his Speed Shell was for children, while Pearl Peru's recipe book offered conventional hints. Mr. Karakwazian could not believe these characters anything but fiction. Yet he had met Captain Quelch. Pearl Peru herself had come calling for him at the Terminal Cafe. And perhaps the magazines were only crude fictions invented for want of the real memories of these heroes and heroines of the Second Ether. Well, no doubt they glamorised the truth like the old dime slots had glamorised N'Chaka, Ali Baba, or Bum Bum Wilson. There was no doubting Captain Quelch's reality or his strangeness, much of which could be put down to an unfamiliar cultural ambiance. But he had not seemed a demigod, merely a clever privateer. Mr. Karakwazian could not imagine the value of reading the magazines, but he conscientiously went through a whole stack, page by page, following the adventures of the Chaos Engineers in their perpetual war against the Singularity, that mighty pseudo-universe enclosed by a vast wall of supercarbon which tore through the scales at a sickening and always increasing rate, ripping ragged holes in the delicate branches and colour fields, forever falling through seeming infinity, forever seeking to impose its simplified and sterile laws upon multiversal variety. Control was their life. By means of ruthless conquest, the Singularity believed they could overcome death. But death was all they ever won. Mr. Karakwazian soon realised to his dismay that the stories were beginning to engross him. The remaining passengers disembarked at Osceola. Boss Van Beek displayed no surprise that he was the only one still aboard. The Rose noted how he showed little interest in his surroundings. He spent hours in his cabin consulting maps which no longer described the realities of his world. Jack Karakwazian was strangely incurious about the man who had once enslaved Kalinda De Vero and would have had her working for him in the north if she had not stolen his charts and gone up the trace to seek out the gold stains. But Von Beek had never been interesting. Like every other tyrant, he was characterised by a stifling banality of mind and a blind devotion to his own greedy self-preservation. A baby. It was hard to imagine the dreams of such people whose desires were on a more primitive plane than those of the majority they controlled. Yet the majority soon became fascinated by them, began imitating them, sought to become them. At some point, it might suit the boss to try and take over the boat. He must certainly be keeping that option. He was too cautious at the moment. He needed their skills. Sam Okenhurst had been for killing Von Beek and the crew of the following boat at night when it would be easy enough, but the Rose had resisted. There's no harm in his going with us for a while. I want no unnecessary conflict, no bloodletting. We know where this boat's headed, and he doesn't. They played a few more games with the brackets. Van Beek's strategies were so primitive and his goals so transparent that it was almost impossible to let him keep winning. But win he did, and became more and more confident in his own superiority. Openly contemptuous of the Jugadors who, to ease their boredom, gave him displays of their most famous moves. Identified with them by everyone who had ever played a flat game, but which Van Beek still did not recognise in spite of those same moves being used in a dozen games Sam Okenhurst had played with him in the past. He could recognise neither pattern nor strategy. His only interest was in winning, which he imagined he did by wild, sudden, brutal plays, following an unconsidered, infantile impulse he called his instinct. The impression, as Jack Karakwazian pointed out, was of playing against an aggressive, unintelligent 10-year-old. Only once, as they sat with their frum after a game, did Bos van Beek focus his eyes on Sam Okenhurst and ask, with the intensity he usually reserved for self-reference, where the boat would be heading after St. Louis. "Oh," Sam Okenhurst offered a faint wink to Jack Karakwazian. "I guess we're heading for hell, Mr. Van Beek. There's nowhere else for us to go." Van Beek had laughed heartily at this, repeating the observation several times. He rose to return to his quarters. "You'll have to come and work for me when I get back to Memphis." "See you in hell," said Jack Karakwazian to Van Beek as the warlord closed the door on them. "Do you think he plans to kill us, Sam?" He suppressed a cough. Sam Okenhurst's elongated fingers, embedded with machinois jewels, delicately touched his fleshless skull. He shrugged. "Men like Van Beek simply see murder as an option. He'll probably work out that we're useful to him, but then decide to kill us anyway. He trusts his instinct, don't he, Jack? They got him where he is." When, with Van Beek, Kalinda De Vero had hardly talked about the man. There'd been nothing to say. He was the usual kind of monster. "We live in a world where casual injustice has become commonplace," she said. "In such worlds, Bos van Beek and his kind flourish. It's their job to finish what others began. They are like those creatures who used to follow armies after the battle. They are the slaughterers and scavengers. That's all. They fulfill a sanitary function." He had suspected her of lack of candour, but now he knew she had been telling only the truth. "Is it the end, Sam? When everything repeats itself forever?" "Well, maybe for you," Sam Okenhurst said, "but most people don't notice. They take comfort from repetition. So should you sometimes. I guess I'm too easily bored. It was always your weakness, Jack. We got too hooked on that old adrenaline running high." But there had been times when it was not so. When he and Kalinda De Vero lay together in the drifting pirogue, watching the lattice of the cypresses reflected from swamp to silvered sky, when the water seemed thick and warm as oil on their bodies and they swam, careless of snakes, in the blood-orange light, gasping with pleasure. They watched the sun go down over the false river and the deserted timber shacks lining her far bank. There had been whiteys living there once, she had said. They had spoken a pure form of Swahili. Nobody knew where they had come from. And then the crows would appear, a great flock of them, lazily flapping through the twilight and cawing to one another like a cheerful congregation after a good sermon, all in Friday black. He had recalled his mentor in Marrakech, Rabia Kul Amal, shaking her head in sadness and wondering why it was that in all her travels everyone she met, Muslim, Hindu, Christian, Buddhist or atheist, yearned for peace, for a harmonious life, yet were always seduced by demagogues. Van Beek had been powerful then. "It is astonishing with what ease we allow others to profit from our pain," she had said. Kalinda had told him that there were some who banded together for the common good, who were opposed to such exploitation. They were known, she said, as the Nation of the Just. Some 12 days later, when they were just above Thebes, they noticed the ease with which the Pearl had made speed up the river. Then they realized that the current was running in the opposite direction. Though they still headed roughly northwards, they were now going downriver. Yet still, Boss Van Beek had not noticed, though his bravos were signalling from the boat, far ahead of the paddle-wheeler, having swept by in the night. They were reversing their own labouring engine, the bulky Cassion swinging eccentrically back and forth in its forward harness. Even the gigantic whitey steersman had a crazy look about him. Now he drew desperate, wailing blasts on his whistle, trying to make La Pearl heave too. The Rose took La Pearl past the gunboat as if she had not seen her. While their master invisible to them, even at this stage, they would not attempt to fire the Cassion. Jack Caraquasian went to find Von Beek. In his cabin, the man wore a long jalaba. There was a strong smell of incense and ope. He was languid, almost amiable. "Your men seem worried about you, boss," Jack Caraquasian told him. "Maybe you should give them a signal to reassure them." Nodding abstractly, George Van Beek took his tiny body to the outer rail and offered his followers something like a benediction. Only slightly reassured, they followed close to the boat, trying to be heard above the racketing paddles, bellowing, garbled inquiries. Boss Van Beek returned to his cabin, while Sam Okenhurst, his features less than reassuring, took a megaphone and told the gunboat's crew that everything was in order. He would meet them in St. Louis. The current remained gentle, but anticipating what was coming, Jack Caraquasian thought he felt it tug a little more aggressively. He was profoundly uneasy. He wondered if Sam Okenhurst and the Rose were completely sane. The Mississippi River was running backwards. It was commonly believed that an abyss lay ahead, into which all this water was pouring. They seemed unconcerned. At what point, he wondered, did one universe impose upon another? He had hardly been aware of a shift. He had expected something more dramatic. Was the final slide toward oblivion always so uneventful? He shrugged off his mood. Meanwhile, Van Beek remained oblivious to everything. They let him borrow one of the brackets, and he became absorbed in it, creating his own crude pseudo-reality. The river was broadening. It was hard to make out the west bank now. Whole towns had already been engulfed, whole forests and mountain ranges. He had remembered his words to Kalinda. When the old hunter came for him, he wanted to be on the river. Maybe God was granting him this part, at least, of his unrealized dream. He stood on the top deck outside the Texas, leaning on a brass rail and staring from side to side at the flat grey expanse of water mirroring an identical sky. Was the whole world slowly evaporating? He moved to look behind him. In the choppy waters of their wake, the gunboat was not far away. Laboring to keep her speed down, she was in increasing danger of being swept on. The muddy wash of both vessels spread out in ever-diminishing ripples until they were indistinguishable from the tiny waves which the wind made on all that lonely water. The birds were gone. If the flood was upon them, they were aboard an ill-equipped ark. It seemed they had not been chosen to carry the race into the next world. Mr. Caraquasian began to laugh, and then he began to cough. A few hours later, when it was dusk, there was nothing to be seen but the water. The waves were higher, breaking against the paddle houses and pouring over the lower deck. There was a wind, too, from the north. It carried an unpleasant, sweet smell. They could hear far away a kind of howling which was obscenely familiar to Jack Caraquasian, though Sam Okenhurst and the Rose did not seem disturbed by it. "It sounds human," said Jack Caraquasian, "like the fault." In the darkness which came upon them quickly, as if they had entered a cave, Jack Caraquasian went to his cabin and lay on his bunk, listening to the river. Its speed continued gradually to increase. When at last he got up, it was dawn and the steamboat was rolling violently in heavy waves. Outside, the spray was high and it was raining. Ahead to starboard, he could just make out through the shifting vapour the gunboat, its engine squealing, tried to reduce the distance between them. He joined the Rose in the wheelhouse and borrowed her glasses, glimpsing terrified faces before the gunboat sank again below his vision. They seemed to be lightening the boat, but the Cassion still bounced in its harness. They were beyond hope and should be praying for a quick death. The boat came up again and he saw the white giant, sweat making the stain run in thin streaks over his face and body, doing everything he could to keep control of the wheel. Jack Caraquasian would not be surprised if his own face had something of the same expression. The Rose had just relieved Sam Okenhurst. It was always obvious when the boat came under her control. There was a steadier feel to their progress, and she used the paddles astutely both to slow and to steer. The Whitey Stokers were performing heroically, tirelessly. She had been given the best. She was now grateful to Sam Okenhurst for persuading her to take them on. No ordinary stoker would have remained with the boat once the river turned round. Most whites were hugely superstitious and would have deserted readily at the first hint of queerness. But these worked almost without rest, with an intelligent, ready response to her needs. Something in her found their obedience distasteful, but she was glad of it. She had a hint, however, of why and how the Mashingwa had trained their whites, and to what impossible humiliations and horrors they had been exposed before the most useful of them survived. Now, of course, they simply bred true. The voice of the abyss was growing stronger now, one vast human shout of pain. Slowly the sky grew pink, then crimson until the diluted blood of millions drizzled upon their decks and stained the cream filigree and confident brass, and they tasted it in their bones until at last even Boss Van Beek emerged complaining and cursing, then stopped to gasp at what he saw. "Where's my boat?" "Your damned boat, sir, is over yonder," said Sam Okenhurst, coming up from below in a yellow mackinaw and pointing. The Rose's laughter was spontaneous. "Mustard just ain't your colour these days, Sam." He enjoyed her humour. In the last few days, their relations had again grown relaxed, and he was sure of her love. He had become increasingly cheerful as Jack Caraquasian had grown increasingly glum. "It's okay once you've done it, Jack," Sam Okenhurst reassured his friend. "The first time's always hard for us." He too began to laugh, and this time it was infectious. Mr. Caraquasian felt his spirits lifting. Then he laughed. Soon only Van Beek had not joined in their merriment. He was rushing back and forth on the top deck, darting down to the hurricane deck and back again. Something had happened to the other passengers. The boat was deserted. What was this? What was this? Where were his people? The rain poured warmer and darker crimson, and the horizon ahead of them boiled with brown vapour from which only little tongues of oily blue and purple darted. Water was now roaring loud enough to drown the noise ahead, yet the Rose made no attempt to halt their progress towards the abyss. The rapids leapt and foamed. They were travelling at enormous speed. The awful horizon grew rapidly closer. Then the water settled into a single, steady, spray-clouded rush. Boiling vapour filled the sky ahead, and that sound of voices rose in their ears so that they shivered with the pain. But Boss Van Beek paced and frowned. He had taken up the Rose's glasses and located his gunboat, whirling helplessly out of sight, its crew waving wretchedly and firing off the Cassion as if they thought they could challenge that frightful apparition and force it to retreat. Then suddenly the gunboat was lifted easily into the air to plunge down again and disappear in a fraction of a moment into the pit. Boss Van Beek began to scream as the yowling chasm dragged La Pearl in the gunboat's wake. And then he stopped. For a moment there was a silence. The vapour cleared. They heard only the water rushing miles wide into a bottomless chasm. Beyond the chasm's edge was no horizon at all. The edge of the world. The clouds boiled up again. The voices dropped to a soft moaning. The boat's prow dipped forward, her paddles clanking powerlessly. Even the Rose had trouble keeping her steering true, weaving with all the currents which surrounded her, selecting, rejecting, taking first one branch and then another until at last she had found the main vein and followed it. It was the best she could do. The three of them were crammed into the Texas, but as soon as he saw he was of no use, Sam Okenhurst went looking for Van Beek, who had vanished below. "I'm a fool," said the Rose to Jack Caraquasian. "I've let Quelch use me. Van Beek's one of his recruits." She began to curse herself so intensely that Jack Caraquasian impulsively embraced her. He thought she had lost her mind. Mr. Caraquasian had never felt so horribly ill. La Pearl's twin stacks poured sparks and grey smoke into freezing air. Jack Caraquasian was reminded of the mint fields and date groves of Marrakech, capital of the Berber Empire, her dark green palms and glittering red walls raised against the royal blue sky, her minarets rippling with pearly colour and her pastel towers beginning to sound the day's fourth prayer. The city seemed to laze in the sun, yet her streets and squares swarmed day and night with the voluble, witty denizens of the least disappointing of fabulous cities. And he thought the paddle wheeler sailed over the rooftops of Marrakech, and he recalled a game played there named after the famous square, Meeting the Dead. Sam Okenhurst came in, shaking his head. The Rose's hands were firmly on the wheel. She had overcome her angry shame. The boat still moved readily to her command, flying out beyond the world's edge, where the water crashed and shrieked out into the bellowing storm, into the fractured air which broke like a slow mirror. When the cracks widened into rivers, they flew down into a narrow vein of scarlet, which bore them through pulsing violet rock and blindingly vivid expanse of pale obsidian. Obsidian became crystal, and all that crystal was a great city, eerie in the distant fading vanilla light as they settled in calm water. Then the Rose began to curse even more violently, rounding on them as if they too were to blame for her dilemma. "He used us just as he wished. Van Beek was Quelch's recruit, and thus we lost our own chance into the second ether. We are marooned here, becalmed for eternity. Oh, my weakness, my fascination with my enemies. It has proved our damnation." "Van Beek's below," said Sam Okenhurst dumbly, staring out at the surrounding beauty, something neither he nor Jack had ever expected to see again. "No, he isn't. No, he isn't." Rose left the wheel and pushed open the Texas door to stalk about on her narrow upper deck. "No, no, no. Van Beek paid for his passage with the blood of his people," she groaned. "No meat boat needed there, my lads. We do not deserve to call ourselves adepts." Sam Okenhurst and Jack Caraquasian searched briefly for Van Beek. "He must have gone overboard," Sam called up to a still grim Rose. She turned her back on him. But Jack Caraquasian, coming from the stokehold, said, "Well, he took the whites with him. They all went into the second ether, I guess." Sam Okenhurst shrugged, "or wherever it was we were. I'm reconciled to this, Jack. It ain't new to me. Whatever it is the Rose wants us to go to, it don't seem to want us. At least we got to keep the boat this time." "It's not bad luck," they heard the Rose say. "It's bad judgment. What hope would we have had anyway? We're numbskulls. The simplest trick in the world." Jack Caraquasian found it hard to share her mood. He had packed himself a rare pipe of M&E and was enjoying it as he leaned on the rail, looking out across the tranquil waters of a lagoon where herons waded in the reeds and huge catfish swam with calm purpose just below the surface, their ancient whiskered faces benign. The oaks in the meadow on the southern bank were beginning to take on a hint of russet, and there was a rich smell of autumn in the air. In that scene of extraordinary peacefulness, Jack Caraquasian found it hard to understand why the Rose should be so disappointed. They had fallen out of the mouth of hell to land somehow in a corner of heaven. He asked Sam Okenhurst what was wrong with the Rose. Mr. Okenhurst explained that they had been duped into carrying a passenger who was a recruit for their opposition. The singularity. "We didn't get close to our goal, a universe we call the Grail. We go through that before we have to make other moves and turns. You learn quickly, like a game. It's hard to explain it any other way, Jack. There don't seem to be words for it." "It's like being a piece and not a player," said Jack Caraquasian. "That's what scares me, Jack. That's what scares me, Sam. Well, we're still players, Jack, but I think we need desperately to get over there. We're running out of luck, and that's why she's worried. My guess is we're just becalmed and can eventually make another attempt, but that ain't her way of responding to a setback. Jack Caraquazian watched a kingfisher fly with swift, irregular wingbeats over the water to hover suddenly, sighting a fish feeding in the shallows and dive, to flash upwards with a wriggling silver body in its triumphant beak. The weak shall devour the strong, said the rose to herself overhead. He could as easily have written me a note. Jack Caraquazian wondered how they had come to this peaceful limbo, which reminded him in indefinable ways of his childhood in Aswan, when he had waded among the rock pools and ponds of the cataracts, while the bright white sails of the little boats, the masts at cryptic angles to the tall palms, went back and forth in the calms, plying from shore to sandy shore. The great grey rocks had glittered like the hides of ancient beasts cooling in the streams. He had watched the ibis striking between the papyrus, and he had wandered through the ruins of so many dead civilizations, learning their languages and their signs, learning their secrets, until gradually he came to understand he must go to Alexandria, to his rebirth, where the adepts taught at the so-called Muzram Berberim. After 3 years, his master had sent him west to Marrakech, red city of storks and miracles. There was no finer training. He had arrived back in Alexandria a proud and full-fledged mukamir, a yugador of the first class. He had returned at length to Aswan. Mukamir, he told his father, they say we are the chosen of God, that only we understand his complex logic. Well, then you are an angel, his father had said, or you blaspheme and are damned for eternity. We are merely his soldiers, Jack Caraquazian had said, defending God's honour and our own. But the civil war had begun, one sect against another, one mosque against another, and untended Egypt's monuments had collapsed. The Nile had grown so clogged with the dead they said you could smell Luxor as far as Nairobi. What was happening to him now was in that sense no worse than what had happened to all his family after the Turks arrived. But by then he had taken the schooner to America. They had told him you could make a lifetime's fortune working just a year on the handsome Mississippi steamboats. But they had not told him what bad losers some men and women could be. Thus he had learned to defend himself. Now his reputation with the weapon was as considerable as his reputation at the deep table. They had been heady years, playing life against death, risking all he had on the quickness of his mind and the speed of his draw, until only the biggest gamblers or most powerful bosses would play against him. And he had joined the small group who dominated the River Queens in the years when society was still gripped by the madness of white power and was profligate with its energies. The lean times had come with energy unaffordable to common folk, but still the landowners and industrialists who wanted the thrill of playing against the best would pay for all the feed that colour demanded. Then they had drilled the fault, and the odds changed radically, became harder to calculate. Yet still they had congregated to play, this time at the terminal cafe to which the old yugadors from many parts of the world had come sooner or later. Now it was all done, thought Jack Caraquazian, watching a family of brown pelicans rise out of the middle of the lake and fly towards the west in a pale yellow sun. All the energy had been used up, and the game was over. He regretted it, but could think of worse places to end his days. I can't change. I'm useless. I'm the most gullible idiot in the multiverse. I deserve to die. The rose was now out of Jack Caraquazian's sight on the other side of the Texas, but he could hear her stamping. He was only remotely sympathetic. He wanted little more than what he had at this moment. He did not believe they were stranded. As he stood dreaming into the water, he caught a distant sound in the sharp fall air, like a polite murmur. Then a drone, rising to a whine, then falling again to a steady purr. He cleared his throat, realizing that he was no longer coughing. Looking up, he saw a huge, old-fashioned flying boat sailing swiftly over the horizon, her wings at a swaggering rake as she studied the paddle boat. He heard the rose break off in mid-curse and utter a loud whoop of joy. "It's a turning world, Jack," says Sam Oakenhurst, coming up beside his friend and watching as the white Dornier, engines sputtering and booming on her upper wings, makes her dignified approach to the lagoon.